This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, as we all know, young people grow up. And that's especially true for foster youth trying to make their transition from the foster home setting into grown-up life. An organization called Foster Success is one of the groups that is helping out here, in particular in Indiana. It's based out of Indianapolis. And with us to talk about not only Foster Success, but also the impact that the bill that has been sent on and signed by President Trump dealing with the stimulus during the COVID-19 pandemic has an opportunity that's going to assist those who are trying to age out of the foster system. Dr. Maggie Stevens is the president and CEO of Foster Success, and she's with us today to talk about it. And Dr. Stevens, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Give us an idea first, what kind of impact that the stimulus bill is going to have put into effect here that's going to help older foster youth be able to make it along and continue their road to success.
You know, it's important to note that when we talk about older foster youth, we're talking about teens and young adults who are aging out of foster care. So for us, those are 14 to 26-year-olds who are aging out, and many don't have a permanent placement and are living on their own. And so over the past 10 months, we have seen this population of young adults significantly impacted because they don't have a family support network to fall back on when their schools are closing, when they are out of work for a period of time. And what we see through this legislation is advocacy work that's been happening for months to provide a financial stability, a backbone, and some additional state and federal dollars to support these young people so that they don't end up homeless or losing their cars or other opportunities. Of most importance, you know, I think one of the things in Indiana and other states as well, but Indiana has been a leader in really trying to provide supportive services to our older foster youth. We were one of the first states that 3 years ago extended foster care services to 21 with some step-down services to 23. What this legislation does is it ensures that no young person is going to be exited from foster care during the pandemic. It provides supportive services actually up until the age of 27, which is important because nationally we're seeing that in our general population, over 50% of young adults under the age 30 are moving back home with their parents, citing the pandemic as the reason to move back home. And again, this population of older foster youth don't have the family members to lean on that many others in our community do.
This is a measure that is, I guess, part of the program, which is entitled the John H. Chafee Foster Care Independence Program. And I guess this is the key part of what Foster Success gets to work with, as I understand.
Definitely. So the Chafee program, as you mentioned, this is an initiative that has been funded to support older foster youth for the past two decades. What's of most significance here is that this increase in funding is actually the first increase in funding for many of the programs under the Chafee bill that we've seen over the past 20 plus years. And we're hopeful that not only will it help young people, young adults make it through this pandemic, but that it will be there to help them thrive and continue to be successful even once we get on the other side of COVID-19.
I understand one of the key points that is brought up and is part of the stimulus bill, which you all, Foster Success, are concerned about, is the opportunity that foster youth have an opportunity once they get to the age of 22 and beyond now that they can re-enter foster care as well as stay in there, I guess, if necessary. Will you explain what that benefit is going to be for the young people that are involved in the program?
Absolutely. So back in May, Governor Holcomb issued through an executive order the opportunity for young people to stay in foster care beyond the age of 21, if need be, during this pandemic. But that is, you know, contingent upon, you know, a monthly renewal of that provision. What this bill does is it allows those young people to stay, to receive supportive services at least through September of 2021. So that provides some stability and letting our young people know that they have the opportunity to continue to work with the case manager and other programs and resources that have been supporting them even prior to the pandemic. It's important to note, too, that these systems and this opportunity to stay engaged with foster care and casework, known caseworkers can help prevent our foster youth from entering or having to lean on and navigate other systems such as unemployment or SNAP or accessing housing vouchers because they have the foster care system to support them and it can help them move forward.
Is that the opportunity that foster youth have, I guess, to avoid, as you say, being involved in the welfare program and in unemployment in particular because they've grown to the age where they can't depend on their foster parents or any other support group?
As they're aging out, you know, we work really hard at Foster Success to provide financial literacy programs to help them with their post-secondary education and job training. But these programs and resources can only go so far. What we find is that without, you know, stable housing, stable transportation, or other resources available to them, you know, giving them the money to pay for college isn't going to help them be successful there. And so what this funding allows for is really the opportunity to provide for those basic needs, housing, transportation, food, et cetera, so that they can focus on seeking employment, seeking job training, and being fully engaged in their education to prepare them for their future.
I know it's very important for foster youth to not only be able to have the parents that they have learned to have because they've been foster children, but they probably want the opportunity, if it's available to them, to be able to get with and to bind, I suppose, with their real parents, don't they? Does this organization that comes under the provisions of the bill help do that?
We are not working directly with Unification at Foster Success, but there are provisions in the bill to allow for family assistance and to help young people stay connected to other adults in their lives.
Now, if there's more information they'd like to get about this work and those involved, not only the foster youth that this would come under through the federal stimulus and funding package, but other organizations, find out more about it?
Yeah, you can visit our website. We have links to summary documents around all of this at fostersuccess.org. And there's a lot more information for young people to access this or others who are looking to get involved.
Dr. Maggie Stevens is the president and CEO of Foster Success, and they're keeping a close eye on the stimulus bill that was passed by Congress and President Trump has signed, with provisions in it that would have an effect on older foster youth as they get older and transition out of the system. And Dr. Stevens, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I was 7 years old when I moved to Valparaiso. Our family moved here in 1969. I was going into the third grade, and I remember we came here, I think, in August, right before school had started. And so I remember we looked at this house, and we thought, wow, a house, you know, opposed to the projects. The neighborhood in Cabrini Green, I remember as a child, I only lived there the first 7 years of my life. So there was three project buildings. One behind ours had 19 floors. It was called the 19-story project building. Ours had, I think, 10. And then the one across had 10. They were red brick buildings. The balcony was fenced in with a green fence so that people, you know, would be safe on the balcony. There was at least 9 apartments on each floor. It had a green elevator, which housed the whole building. So if the elevator got stuck, you had to walk up all those flights with all your groceries. I remember you couldn't go downstairs and play in the playground after dark. It wasn't safe. I remember going to Jenner School, and there's a Jenner School and a Bird School, elementary school. And if you didn't go to Bird School, the kids from Bird School would beat you up. If you went to the playground downstairs, if you were a Jenner School student, I remember having your swings snatched from you because there's only four working swings. So if you went to Jenner School, the kids from Bird School would make you get off the swing so they can swing. There was a lot of positive things growing up in Cabrini-Green, and there's a lot of negative things as well. You made a lot of friends. You didn't have to worry about color opposed to growing up in Valparaiso. You fit in Cabrini-Green, and that was home. That was home until we came here in 1969. I remember we walked in, the house needed a lot of work, and so Project Neighbors, I think it was called VBA back then, they constantly worked on my mom's house. They were always in her house hammering or doing something. My mom wanted to get rid of us out of the house. So she said, why don't you kids go play? So we thought, okay, let's go play. And of course, any kid is looking for a kid to go play with. And so not really knowing Valparaiso, you know, not knowing the prejudice that exists before us, we found some kids across the street and we walked across the street to introduce ourselves before we could even get like 3 feet in front of the little girl, she runs away. So it's kind of funny to think back. So she runs away and we run after her. And so she starts crying, you know, and we didn't do anything to her. So she just said, get away from me. So my sister and I went to the playground by ourselves to play. And then later she comes to the playground with her older sister and we just kind of looked at her like, okay, you didn't want to play with us, but here you are now. And so she said, I had to run away from you guys because my parents don't allow us to play. And so I said, what's a? And she said, well, my parents told me it's you colored people. And being from Chicago, I never heard those terms. I never heard or color person, not even the word. Okay, just didn't hear it. So she goes, well, my parents said that Jigaboo's a color person. A color person is a. So I went home, of course, and asked my mom, was it? And she said, well, that's just an old time slavery demeaning word for black people. You know, so I understood that concept. Then I asked her, well, what's colored people, mom? And so she said, well, that's just a term used for Negroes. You know, back then we didn't say African Americans, we said Negroes. For this little girl to play with us and her sisters, they had to sneak to the park and play with us. And I remember once her parents or her mom brought binoculars over to the front part of the park and looked through binoculars at her children. And so the minute she saw them playing with us, she would call them by name and tell them to come home. Her kids would say, oh, we're in trouble now because we're caught. They kept saying the word because we're caught playing with you. That was trying to find friends in our neighborhood. The other families with their children were fine, with their children interacting with African-Americans. It was just that particular family that wanted to poison the whole neighborhood and tell the whole neighborhood, you shouldn't allow your kids to play with those. I asked a question to one of her daughters. I said, why is your family like that? You know, our family's not like that. Why is your family like that? Again, this is age 7 or 8 years old. And so she said, well, my mom told us that her uncle was killed by a black man, and that's why she doesn't like black people. I said, oh, okay, I get it. I get it. But, I mean, we tried to wave at her, the mother. We tried to speak. She would not speak. She would not wave. As the years went by, like I say, 25 years later, I mean, that's when they began to just say hello.
You can find more original stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's no doubt that the coronavirus pandemic has made its mark on Northwest Indiana. We've seen schools close. We've seen fewer workers on the trains and the buses to go to work, if they have jobs, unfortunately. Traffic congestion on the highways has declined, and there have been lots of changes in how we hold meetings when it comes to work and sometimes personal calls. And that is also being reflected in commerce here in Northwest Indiana, in particular in e-commerce. Well, the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission has taken time to study the COVID-19 impact on e-commerce. In fact, they've created a report about it, and let's find out more about that report. Ty Warner is Executive Director of NERPSE, and he's joining us today to talk about it. Ty, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
Chris, great to be with you. Glad to be here. And thanks for talking about this topic. This is important for the future of our region.
Well, it's very important. And I know from the report, even though I just took a look at some of the basic details, the full report's on the website for NERPC, by the way, if anybody wants to check it out. But it talks about the major changes, the shifts in commerce that we have seen, some rather dynamic shifts. Why don't you just break it out for us? Tell us where we've seen the big changes as a result of the pandemic and what impact it's had on all businesses in the region.
Absolutely. You know, it's always interesting when data backs up what your anecdotal experience is, and that's certainly the case now. And the timing with this report, we started this before the pandemic. E-commerce was already a big part of the shift in the economy, which I think we all knew. But now with the pandemic upon us and the drastic decreases in travel and the way people are conducting business and their willingness to go out and all of the rest, even more timely and more important for the future of the region. So let me just start, first of all, by saying this all originated by our NWI 2050 document, which is our regional vision plan for the future of Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. And that is, we adopted that in 2019 and already identified the importance of e-commerce and how much the landscape was changing in the drastic increase in the amount of retail. Changes in retail trips, and that bore out by a household travel survey that we conducted, which many of your listeners may have received. This was randomly sent across Lake Porter and LaPorte counties, and people responded to where they were going, all voluntary, of course. But that was pulled together in the aggregate and then analyzed. And boy, one of the things that jumped out at us right away was the difference in retail trips. Back in 2008, when we had last done this household travel survey, over 21% of retail trips were for shopping trips, retail, mm-hmm. going to stores and whatnot. And then the results of the survey, which was largely in 2018, that had dropped to 9%. So 12% decrease just in 10 years of retail trips. And that just bears out, I think, everybody's experience, much more online, much more purchasing of things getting delivered right to your door, coupled with the increase that we're seeing on the roadway that I think everyone sees when they're out and about is the increase in, Amazon Prime trucks, FedEx, UPS, even to the point where they're having to rent, you see the budget and U-Haul, rent a truck, so to speak, coming to deliver your packages because it's that difficult to keep up with demand. Well, that's during the pandemic. Even before that, between 2014 and 2018, truck traffic has already been drastically increasing, whereas overall, we measure, this gets a little technical, but we measure vehicle miles traveled for the region. And that has stayed somewhat flat between 2014 and 2018, a very, very minor increase. But truck traffic has definitely increased. And I think that's all a result of the way that we do shopping and the way that we do commerce.
Now, what do you all find at NERPC in putting together the report of the impact? Not only, as you mentioned, we have fewer trips made to the store over time. We have more vehicles on the road. These are delivery trucks, the ones that are marked and the ones that aren't marked, because a lot of these prime trucks are not marked as such, but they're still out there.
Right.
And what are you finding as far as the storefronts of the big box stores and brick and mortar stores? What's the impact of all been on them right now?
Right. Well, I think a lot of your listeners have already experienced, beloved restaurants, shopping opportunities, things that they had long thought would just be around forever, suddenly surprised to find out that they've needed to close their doors in some cases. And in other cases, some have been able to pivot in this circumstance and be able to adopt. And I just know, and I'm sure your listeners have similar experiences, when you just talk to some of these business owners, some of them have really been creative about finding out how to survive in this particular climate and have adjusted. It's interesting when you talk to folks that have done this in a great deal of depth. Sometimes you hear the term retail apocalypse being used as if everything is completely on a downward spiral. And some of the folks that have really studied this very carefully, who are much more well-versed in the economics of this than I am, really kind of put a caution on using that phrase, because there is some thought out there, and it seems to be bearing out with other data, that the decline is probably looked at more in terms of a right sizing than an actual just complete plummet of brick and mortar stores.
Right.
So as e-commerce has been available, that's helped to, you know, how do you put this? I don't want to sound like this is some kind of survival of the fittest, but in some way it has put the pressure on so that those that maybe were less solid, and I want to be careful here. I do not want to say that somebody who has not been able to survive in this climate has somehow done something wrong. That's not the message. But it's just been that there has been a decrease in retail that may be just getting to a level where it probably should have been at, rather than the overexpansion that we've seen in this country over a long period of time. So that is one definite way to look at that. But the upshot is that this new change in how we do commerce is here to stay. The amount of just employment growth in different sectors, 50% increase in warehousing and storage. So this all has ramifications for where we go with this. And even in the amount of warehousing as a part of our economy, we have a greater percentage of that than Indianapolis in our economy. Not to mention, we are still in relative proximity to Indianapolis, where the second largest FedEx hub is. So we're really well positioned with our transportation network. The same network that gives rise to calling us the Crossroads of America is the very thing that helps goods and delivery like this excel, and we're right in the heart of it and well poised to, I think, take advantage of what the future may hold.
We're talking with Ty Warner. He's the executive director of the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. NRPC has put out a new report entitled E-Commerce in Northwest Indiana. You can check it out on their website. And I know there's some recommendations. I'd like to touch on those here in a minute, Ty, but tell us a little bit about some of the areas here in Lake Porter and LaPorte counties that you all have noted that, as it says in the report, are uniquely positioned for growth. Tell us about those first.
Exactly. Well, we did a land use study, which is part of what we do, and I should just encapsulize for your listeners. NRPC is a council of governments. We are a unit of government, but we are not a layer of government. We are a body where all the 41 municipalities in Lake Porter and LaPorte counties come together on a regular basis to talk about things that are bigger than any one of them. And so part of that charge as a regional planning commission is to look at future trends and try to project growth to meet our other important designation, which is a Metropolitan Planning Organization for federal transportation funds. So this all works together in how you plan out the future of our connectivity and mobility in the region. Mm-hmm. So as part of that data, we looked at locations that are most conducive to e-commerce and where that can function at the most efficient level based on the particular needs of what goes into e-commerce. And we looked at five different clusters around the region and tried to analyze what is the best performing in terms of connectivity, being able to take advantage of these locations for e-commerce. So what the report tries to do in amongst its recommendations is to lay out, here is how this region can best position itself to try to take advantage of this future trend.
I know that there are some recommendations that the report is putting out, and you can check out in more detail, that tells, that gives some ideas at least on how some organizations and businesses and all can try to adapt and deal with the changeover, as we're seeing a big change in e-commerce from the usual traditional visit to the store. What are some of these recommendations that the full report talks about?
Sure. Well, I think one of the biggest ones that is most exciting to think about because of the opportunity involved is, as we've seen declines in shopping malls and other retail businesses, there are some great examples of the way communities have adaptively reused some aging mall facilities and big box retail and whatnot for other uses, whether that's to, as the report highlights, the occasion where a whole big box facility was transformed into a really stunning public library facility, to another shopping mall that integrated a whole hospital healthcare facility as part of the mall. And even just, I just saw just the other day, a little closer to home, Fox Valley Mall in Aurora, Illinois. And a proposal for a mixed-use development to take advantage of transforming part of the anchors in that store to be mixed-use development, which means, you know, not only commercial but also residential and senior living facilities and a way to integrate that into and coexist with existing retail. Mm-hmm. So there's some exciting examples we can pull from for adaptively reusing some of the facilities that are we're seeing a shift in their use. And then some of the other recommendations in the report that I think are really helpful for us to think about in the future for a host of reasons, but this is one of them, is the importance of the curb. And that sounds so basic to just talk about the curb, but especially when you're talking about your downtown areas or areas that are a bit more congested, as we move not only into more of an e-commerce environment, but as autonomous vehicles are on the horizon and that technology just keeps getting further and further along, the ability to transfer not only goods, but people right in front of businesses and locations becomes all the more important. So you may not have thought so much about the space in front of your store previously, but now in the midst of the pandemic, when so many restaurants are doing, you know, curbside service, and you're seeing locations that are marked, you know, keep this free for takeout only or curbside service only, right, so that the curb stays free. Already we're getting to that point where we're paying a lot more attention to what happens right on the street, right in front of the business. And that's only going to get more important as you have more and more deliveries happening and needs to be able to be efficient so that it doesn't block traffic, to be able to release their goods and move on to, as I mentioned, autonomous vehicles. When, again, I'm looking pretty far out, but that's what we try to do.
Well, they have to do that.
Absolutely. And that picture is one of, you know, for many, thinking that maybe a shared option, much like ride hailing, things like Uber and Lyft and all that, where the autonomous vehicle comes, picks you up on demand, but you don't necessarily own it. But even if you do, the idea is that it comes picks you up where you are. And again, all the more important to manage that curb space for efficient delivery. And like I said, not just packages that you order off of online retail, but on down the road, potentially yourself, as you travel here and there and want the vehicle to drop you off in front of a particular business.
Well, it sounds like, too, that it's something that in the report is going to be something that public officials here in Northwest Indiana should take a look at, because it may involve some serious changes in their tax revenue status.
It could. And while I don't want to put myself as being qualified to speak too much on that particular shifting landscape there, obviously there's some changes in use. And when you have changes in use, you have changes in revenue. And so I think it would behoove all of our communities to look carefully at what the future holds and try to adapt accordingly, which we say all the time on a bigger scale anyway. But particularly with this report, this brings it a little bit. Our plan goes out to the year 2050 that I mentioned, NWI 2050. Well, this is in the next, you know, few years we're talking about. So this is the here and now, and I think communities would do well to try to do what they can to pivot their communities to take advantage of that future. And NERPC is here to help with this. That's what we do.
Thank you for this great information. And here again, the full report, e-commerce in Northwest Indiana, is on the NERPC website, nerpc.org. And you can find out all the details if you'd like to dig into it deeper. Ty Werner is the executive director for NERPC. And thank you very much for being with us today and giving us this executive summary of the report. It's a great report to take a look at. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Appreciate being on.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A construction safety expert from a commercial and industrial contractor here in Northwest Indiana has been spending some time with Purdue University Northwest students, a little experiential learning for the students to teach them better about how to deal with construction safety issues, and especially the best practices for dealing with safety issues on the job site. We have with us today to talk about it Don Hancock. He's the safety coordinator for the Panger Corporation, which is based in Gary. And Don, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris.
Give us an idea first, what got you involved in working with Purdue University Northwest, and in particular with the university's Department of Construction Science and Organizational Leadership?
The company I work for, Chris, the Panger Corporation, and like you said, we're out of Gary, and we've been out of Gary for about 115 years now. This is a family-owned business, and this is the fourth generation. The company here, they constantly educate our people, our field people and our office people and our foremen with training. And we train and retrain throughout the years. Sometimes we get a lot of blowback from people because it's the same thing over and over and over. But the training here is constant. As a member on the Northwest Indiana Business Roundtable, the professor, Soji Nakamani at PNW, asked us if anyone would be interested in volunteering our time to help his students. And that's about how this came around.
I find it interesting that the roundtable has called this program a train when it rains. It's an opportunity, I guess, to help train people when you can't go out there and work on the job site.
Yes, what happens is a lot of the people that are members of the Northwest Indiana Business Roundtable are field professionals, such as myself. I'm a career carpenter before I moved into the safety coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the other contractors have iron workers, painters, laborers, teamsters, people that have years of experience. And anybody that's worked construction knows sometimes you get rainout days. So basically, instead of going home on a rainout day, Soji's asked us to volunteer our time and help teach these students.
That's great. That's great. What got these other craftspeople involved in the program to begin with, and of course you in particular, since you're a safety coordinator with Pangier?
Well, Pangier is a multi-traded union company. We have laborers, iron workers, painters, and teamsters. And as far as a union company, the number one thing that a union company has to offer to our customers is our safety. And I mentioned earlier that we constantly train our people, and over, we have quarterly safety meetings, and it's a pretty big deal, actually. Sometimes we have up to 200 and 300 employees at a time here at our office and train them on all the important things that are required by our customers to work in their facilities.
Mm-hmm. How did you all create this program working with Professor Nakayama at Purdue Northwest to be able to create something for students to work on and actually get some real-life experience and how they in turn can eventually, when they get involved out there in the workday world, to be able to train staff members?
Well, I have to give all the credit to that to Professor Nakayama. He put this program together himself, and it was very slow going at the beginning because he had trouble getting people to volunteer. But then when he started expressing his concerns and telling people how this would be applicable in the real world, the volunteers started coming in. But the entire program is put together by Soji, so the credit needs to go to him.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess the assignment is, I understand, to help the students put together a presentation on certain topics, which in turn, I guess, they get out there to work, they will be able to pass along to employees to deal with workplace hazards and things like that. Can you tell us a little bit more about the assignment?
Well, this last assignment was, there's several different topics that they get to choose from that are applicable to the real world. And the last one that I helped with was struck by and caught between, which are pretty big OSHA required areas.
Mm-hmm.
They're covered by the OSHA standards pretty heavily. This particular assignment was a group of students, and they contacted me. They were going to put together a PowerPoint presentation. I don't really like to lead their project. So what I tend to do is give them clues and directions to go into. And with this specific group, they were very well informed, and they had a lot of information before they even contacted me. So I directed them to OSHA letters of interpretations for the struck by and caught between topics. And they put together a very great presentation. It was about a 7-minute presentation, but lots of times when people do PowerPoint presentations, we get what's called death by PowerPoint.
Yeah.
So these students were able to mix in a little bit of humor and a little bit of their personal taste into the PowerPoint, and they did a very great job showing that they had a grasp of the knowledge.
That's good. Was it difficult, do you think, for them to come up with this PowerPoint presentation that not only is, I guess, entertaining to a point, like you say, you're not going to be bored to death, be sure, for this presentation, but that actually you'll learn something, and especially to make sure that the students understand it as well. Don Hancock is a safety coordinator with the Gary-based Pangier Corporation, and he has been working with Professor Soji Nakayama with the Purdue University Northwest Department of Construction Science and Organizational Leadership on this real-world experience for students in the classes to learn more from the professionals in the field about dealing with issues, in this case, about safety training material.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we will have both recent conversations on St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer and our conversation with Jill Long Thompson about her book, Character of American Democracy. Hope you can join us for that.